Hello, I'm Curtis Bowers, and this is Agenda Weekly. Thank you so much for joining me again this week. I really appreciate it. I hope you've had a good week, and I hope you're being successful in building a simple, meaningful life and in this crazy world that we live in. I've got a special show today. I'm going to be interviewing Patrick Wood, and we're going to talk about his new book, The Evil Twins of Technocracy and Transhumanism. I think you'll enjoy it. He's been warning people about technocracy and now the transhumanist movement for decades and knows an awful lot about it. But it's two of the greatest threats that are facing mankind right now. A couple things to bring up before we get to that. One, if you're watching this on Rumble, if you would like it and then follow us, that would be a great blessing to help us reach more people the way the algorithms work. It helps it get out to more people, so we'd appreciate if you do that. We'd also like to encourage you to go to agendaweekly.com and become a subscriber there if you're interested, where you can get all the resources we provide each week. Couple news stories to hit on. Chick-fil-A, which has been known as a Christian company for so long because of their founder, Truett Cathy, who was a wonderful man. But unfortunately, his children have taken it in a different direction. I got a text from them a week or so ago. It said this: Chick-fil-A Inc.'s commitment to being better at together means embedding diversity, equity, and inclusion in everything that we do. Their mission statement used to be, when Truett Cathy was alive, our mission is to glorify God in all that we do. They might still have that as a mission statement, but it's not. Now their mission statement is this: embedding diversity, equity, and inclusion in everything that we do. So sad to see them fall, like is so common in the Christian circles. Don't go to Chick-fil-A anymore. Another thing I wanted to bring up, as we had last week, we talked about the technological gulag that's being built around us through social media and all the modern technology. And as I was thinking more about that, one point I didn't make, but I think it's important, is you know the ultimate goal is totalitarian communist control. Here's how you know that. When we're walking down this road where they're creating dependency by getting us connected with people, by throwing ads up in front of us to influence us and to move us in a certain direction, which we know is a direction of being dependent on them. You'll own nothing and be happy. Well, then you realize the ultimate goal is not to sell us things, because in that world, we won't have any disposable income to buy anything. So then you realize, no, it's about total totalitarian control and nothing else. Right now, they're using the ads to make money to build the cage around us. But in the end, the future they're selling, all those ads in the future will be just like they are in China. Not trying to sell people things. It's propaganda. It's trying to brainwash them into believing the government is the solution to every problem. And if you rebel against the government, you will be punished because you deserve to be. That's the bottom line of that. And lastly, before the interview, McIlvaney.com is the company that we encourage you to go to if you are interested in purchasing gold and silver. It's a family business of my wife's family. It's been in business for 50 years, and they're happy to answer any questions you have. But I'm on their email list, and you ought to get on their email list, even if you're not buying anything right now, because they send out just vital economic information on a regular basis. And this week, one of their emails said this: WEIS Ratings, which is the nation's only independent rating agency that regularly evaluates the safety of U.S. banks and credit unions, has warned that right now, this is kind of shocking, 12.8% of all financial institutions in America have a red flag warning right now, which means imminent failure is very possible. 31% of other financial institutions have a yellow warning flag, which means they are unhealthy and heading toward collapse as well. So that's 45% of all the banks, credit unions, and things like that are being rated as vulnerable right now. So if you go to McIlvaney.com, you can sign up there or you can call them on their number, but they can provide you the ratings for your banks, your credit unions, your insurance companies, annuities, or other things that you're involved with. And they can tell you, yeah, that's a safe one, or no, that's not, which might be helpful to you. And then also, if you're still interested in just learning more about precious metals, they're the best source for that, McIlvaney.com. But anyway, I hope you enjoy this interview and learn a lot and share it with others, because we need to understand what's going on to effectively stand against it. Patrick Wood, thank you so much for joining me again.
My pleasure, Curtis. Always good to be with you.
I appreciate you and all you're doing to wake up the troops about what's going on. And before we get into some of the new things going on, could you just give us an overview of technocracy? You're kind of the godfather of technocracy in this modern age. For the last, you really are. You, for the last 45 years, you've been educating America on the threat of this and what it is and why we have to be alert to it. So just kind of give an overview of it and some of the reasons people need to understand what it is.
Right. Originally, the technocracy movement started in the early 1930s at Columbia University in New York City. That was in the heat of the Great Depression. Many people, especially the progressive crowd, thought that capitalism was going to die once and for all. It was gone. Dead man walking. So a group of scientists and engineers, primarily at Columbia University, said, we can do better. Where have you heard that before? We can do better. And so they decided to create a brand new economic system from scratch. They were going to engineer it, if you will. And so they figured, well, we're smart guys. We got science on our side, whatever. We can craft a new economic system that would be controlled by science and would, but namely us. And that we would launch this new economic system as soon as capitalism is dead. And they felt so strongly about it at the time that they even officially and formally appealed to FDR, who was just being seated in 1933. They appealed to him to declare himself dictator for the sake of implementing technocracy summarily. Well, thank goodness he didn't take us up. He didn't take them up on that, right? He said no. As being a politician, he realized that if he had said yes, they asked him, said, well, just dismiss Congress for starters. Just send them all home. We don't need any more elected officials. Just create essentially an organizational chart, like you have a modern org chart with a continental director and then regional directors and service directors and all this kind of stuff, all appointed to run the entire economic system by algorithm, by their science and without any public input or comment. And, you know, this was so dangerous. It got rejected ultimately in America, and it kind of fizzled in the 40s, especially after World War II really got cooking. But it was a very prestigious group of people that created this in the first place. And even though they didn't have institutional money behind them at that point, like the Rockefellers, for instance, when the early 1970s rolled around, another young professor, relatively young professor at Columbia University, kind of revisited the whole topic and created he wrote a book called Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. That was Zbigniew Brzezinski, brilliant political strategist, dead now. But I would disagree with everything he probably said, but he was a brilliant political strategist, right? Totally.
Yeah.
He wrote a number of books that were earth-shaking books, politically speaking, political science, geopolitics, etc. Brzezinski brought this idea back to the world stage, caught the eye of David Rockefeller, who said, this is good stuff. We could use this for our own, our own goals of globalization and creating this new international economic order that they said they were going to create in 1973 when the commission was founded. And so from that point forward, modern globalization, I personally believe very strongly that that was the watershed moment for modern globalization. It was in the early 1970s. All kinds of things were going on back then, by the way. Lots of things were going on. The dollar had just been decoupled from gold. It's a banker's problem, you understand, at that point. When the money that you're profiting off of no longer has any type of anchor, as a banker, you should be concerned, because eventually, you can do the math, eventually the fiat currency will completely get wiped out. It'll lose all of its value eventually. So what's a banker to do? And David Rockefeller at that time was a good, he's a good banker, you see. He was chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank and one of the largest global banks in the world at the time. He realized there was a problem. Eventually, better prepare for it now. And that's how Brzezinski's book came in. That's how the Trilateral Commission came in, to foster, as they said, quote unquote, foster a new international economic order. And everything since then, look, we can look back from here to 1973 and see all the string of events from what they have done to bring this new international economic order to fruit. And we're dealing with it today. We're living with it today. This is what the Great Reset is all about with the World Economic Forum. And we have to remember, too, that the World Economic Forum was originally started in 1971, just about the same time everybody was cooking up this Trilateral Commission business. And it was Henry Kissinger who sent Klaus Schwab over back over to Europe with the idea, guys, you need to start this thing over there for us, because we need to have a wing in Europe, a complete wing separate from the Trilateral Commission, but to do certain things for us in Europe. And that became the World Economic Forum that we know today. So they're still very, very closely aligned with each other, you know, economically, ideologically, et cetera. And they're promoting the system of technocracy. It's essentially scientific dictatorship.
That's right.
So, that in a nutshell. And by the way, I have to say, scientists and engineers can build factories, they can build machines, and the machines obey them. They obey them. A good engineer builds a good machine. The machine will run forever. Of course, they don't run. Things wear out, things break, you got to fix it. But that's no problem for a good engineer. They figure that out. Yeah, it's going to, you know, pulley's going to wear out 5 years. We'll be ready for it, man. We'll swap it out and thing will just keep going. The problem they had early on, and they realized this, was they can make the factories, they can make the country look like a machine and work it, you know, like a fine-tuned factory, but you got to have people to run the factory, to work there. You have to have people in it. Unfortunately, they would like to not have people, but they have to have people. So what do you do with the people? Because people don't obey. The people don't want to do what you tell them to do, and they strike and they, you know, jump out of windows and whatever. But, you know, you got people problems. So they picked up on this early on, and they defined their own technocracy movement in multiple points in their definition. But it always started out with technocracy is the science of social engineering. That was always the first thing in their definition. Then they would go on to say it's an economic system. But it started out with the science of social engineering. Now, we can see this. This is the validation. Today, we can see this so-called, I call it pseudoscience, but, you know, science of social engineering. We can see social engineering all around us today. Every conceivable way, government's involved with it, big tech's involved with it, European Union's involved with it, the military, the, you know, all agencies, the U.S. government involved with this science of social engineering, to manipulate people into doing things that they would not otherwise do. And they're masters at it, absolute masters at it.
That's right.
So that kind of brings us up, you know, where we are today. I believe we're dealing with a lot of the stuff today, and it still is largely unrecognized. So, you know, here we are talking about it. That's a good thing.
Yeah, no, it is. So people, what it is all the things you've been noticing and concerned with, all coming together. We're like in Canada during the trucker convoy, which I know you all are familiar with.
Yes.
We love that movement, but the government was able to zero out your bank account or do these other things to you. That's technocracy. That's the foundation of technocracy, where eventually you have to obey, or you will just be eliminated your existence will be eliminated. They don't even have to have the firing squads. They probably will just for the fun of it. But you don't have to be. You lose your job. You lose your health care. Okay. You lose your education. You lose your bank account. You lose your place to stay. Mm-hmm. And so they just, but that's what they're setting up right now. That's why this is so important. They've had these ideas, like he said, for 90 years ago. They were like, this is what we need to do. But the technology wasn't in line with their mm-hmm. dreams. So that's why back then in the 30s, they loved the Stalins of the world because they were doing it by force. And they said, that's great, but that's hard to do. It's hard to force everybody with power to do what you want. If we can control them from behind the scenes and set up this system, then we will be like a Stalin, but it won't appear that way because people, when they get zeroed out, no one will know about it. Mm-hmm. So tell me, and there's many things that I know you've been studying, so bring up anything that's relevant to this, but your new book that came out just a few months back, The Evil Twins of Technocracy and Transhumanism. A lot of people would go, technocracy and transhumanism fit together, whatever. But give us kind of an overview of that book so people will get it, because they need to. It's so important. Yes. But then how those things are working together, really.
I'm happy to say, by the way, that I released the audiobook about a month ago. So great. Now there's the Kindle version, there's the audiobook, and there's also the paperback book as well. Oh. It's available. So, you know, I'm hoping people won't find any more excuses to not get a hold of it. You know, it's like I can't force feed them, but you know, you hope people will take an interest in and pick it up and read it. What happened? I'll approach it this way. Both transhumanism, well, I've kind of defined technocracy. Transhumanism is the redefinition of mankind in terms of technology. The transhuman movement has always sought to achieve immortality, to achieve omniscience and godlike qualities, etc. Before 1990 or so, transhumanism was just a metaphysical exercise and nothingness, in my opinion. Just a bunch of kooks, you know, talking in a back room. They had no way to achieve it, right? But when science really started picking up, especially genetic engineering started to pick up steam in the 1990s, the transhuman movement glommed onto that and said, that is our meal ticket to immortality. This is how we're going to do it. We're going to take over the evolutionary process. We're going to take over genetic engineering of everything in the world that lives, and then also through nanotechnology, things that don't live as well, to create new forms of matter and so on. And all of a sudden, they found themselves rubbing up against the technocracy movement. Same science, right? It was the same body of science, but it was serving two people, and they realized all of a sudden that they were merging together. So, and kind of the same sense during World War II, you know, you had the Allies and you had the Axis, and, you know, they were odd bedfellows, some of them, but they got together. That's what's happened with technocracy and transhumanism. Technocracy seeks to transform the economic system of the world, where now transhumanism seeks to transform the people that are going to live in that new system. This is a very symbiotic relationship they have now, and I don't know that anybody really saw that coming back in 1970. I didn't, certainly.
Yeah.
But now you can see it just as plain as the nose on your face. They're in cahoots with each other, lock, stock, and barrel. And in Silicon Valley, for instance, you find many people who would identify completely with technocracy also are identifying with transhumanism. People like Elon Musk, for instance, who has invested hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars into life extension companies. Peter Thiel is another one. Class A1 technocrat on one hand, but he's also a hardcore transhumanist seeking to conquer death. And he's invested billions of dollars in it. And you could go on, you could Jeff Bezos, and there's a bunch of other people we could point to. To say, okay, you see that they're both together now. They're technocrats and they're transhumanists together. They have no obvious ideological differences that would keep them apart. The World Economic Forum has adopted this whole mantra as well. When Klaus Schwab talks about the Great Reset, there's two parts to the Great Reset. Most people just look at the dictatorship part, you know, the you'll own nothing and be happy. Forget the happy. They want us to own nothing. Well, somebody's got to own it. It's just not going to be us. It'll be them. But out of the other side of Klaus Schwab's mouth, he talks very openly about the Fourth Industrial Revolution and transhumanism. And he says the Fourth Industrial Revolution is not just about changing the world. He said it's, he says it very emphatically with his fingers going like this, you know. Eat the bugs, you know, sort of thing. But he's, but he says the Fourth Industrial Revolution is going to change you. In other words, then he goes on to talk about genetic engineering and how machine and man are going to merge together, the technology, and they're going to be cyborgs and downloading your mind into computers and all this kind of stuff, the singularity concept. So Klaus Schwab has is a kind of the pinnacle of the World Economic Forum. He's picked up on this. He says, yes, this makes perfect sense. We're going to transform society into society 2.0. And then we're going to transform humanity into humanity 2.0. And doesn't this bring up a biblical concept only to us, not to them? But you don't put new wine into old wineskins, right? So, and maybe no, people don't understand the point there. When wineskins cure the wine, they stretch and then they harden. And if you try and do that process twice, say, well, I got this old wineskin. I used it last year. I'm going to use it again this year. And you pour new wine in it, it'll burst because it tries to stretch it again. And it will break. So everybody in the wine business, and even back in biblical days, they knew this. You don't put new wine into old wineskins. They only have one use. And in this kind of in the same sense, why would you build a new global economic system only to put the old people that ruined the first one into it? You see, because that's their mindset. You people out there, you people, that's talking to you and me, right? You people are the ones that ruined the world, you see. And we're going to change you. We're going to transform you into humans 2.0. And then we're going to usher you into this new utopian-like system, they say, and everything will be copacetic because, you know, we got 2.0 here and 2.0 here, and the people in the system are going to do what we tell them to do. They'll own nothing and be happy. They say, well, you'll be happy. Maybe they're going to give us enough soma drug or something. It's going to just maybe magic mushrooms. You know, maybe psilocybin might be the answer to this to make everybody happy. Back in the 30s, the technocrats and the communists hated each other. They had no use for each other, and they argued incessantly. They debated, they fought, they wrote newspaper articles scathing each other. And the reason the technocrats never accepted the communists is the communists were not willing to abandon the price-based economic system. That is money as value. The technocrats insisted on using energy as their currency. It's a big difference. So the communists were not willing to budge, and the technocrats said, look, if you're going to run an economic system, which in their mind, any dummy would say, an economic system runs on energy. You have to have energy. The more energy you put in, the more robust the economic system will be. If you take energy out, the less robust it's going to be. It's going to shrink. That's self-evident to most people if you think about it. So they believed that everything should be priced in terms of the energy that went in to make the things that you're buying. Value had no issue to them. I mean, no place for value. If that shirt that you're wearing, or the shirt that I'm wearing here, has a theoretical value, which I think you could probably calculate somehow, I can't, but as a scientist, you could say, well, you know, the cotton was grown in Egypt, and then it went on a ship, and it went to a loom, and then the fabric went to Sri Lanka, it got sewed up, blah, 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 and then it got shipped to Macy's, you know, whatever, somewhere. you could probably trace back all the different things and figure out how much energy went into buy to make this shirt. That would be the price you'd pay for the shirt. It would be in terms of ergs, that's units of energy, rather than in currency based on supply and demand. That's a huge difference. It sounds like it's, you know, you're kind of straining at a gnat here, Wood. No, this is very significant difference between what you and I know. We grew up with a price-based economic system based on, you know, the free market economics is into it, but supply and demand is a basic thing. If supply goes down and demand is still high, the price goes up and vice versa. Not with technocracy. One size fits all, one price fits all, and it's based on energy calculations. And that's the way they wanted to price the whole system. We see energy today taking a center role in the world. Mm-hmm. We see the war on carbon, for instance, where I don't want to use the term fossil fuels, that's incorrect, but oil, natural gas, things that come out of the ground have been declared evil. And alternative energy is the big thing now, you know, windmills and whatever. Well, the issue here is you can't control an essentially limitless source of energy like gas and coal and oil. It cannot be controlled, but you can control alternative energy because you have a choke point that you can control it very precisely. This is a technocrat's dream, to control the energy. That's how they're going to control the entire mechanism of the economic system in the world, is by controlling energy. Does this make sense, or am I just kind of rambling here?
And it makes sense then, because of that, that's why the environmental movement is so vital to the whole thing, because that's the way to control the energy then.
Yes.
You can limit its production because, damaging the planet, or you can switch it to a much more expensive energy source like the solar and wind that's not reliable, so it makes it, again, more expensive. Anything that makes it go up makes us go down, makes the poverty of the world go up. It makes sense. And a couple of things you said a minute ago before I forget about the magic mushrooms and things. as you know, Yuval Harari says the future of mankind is video games and drugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's their world. That's what they want it to be, where we're completely useless, we're obsolete, because their technocratic and transhumanist society is able to do all the things that need to be done with artificial intelligence and everything. Yeah. But also, I thought of something else. I remember reading some books on Karl Marx. And when Charles Darwin came up with the theory of evolution, he knew it was key. Karl Marx even wrote Darwin and said, "You've given us what we need now, an explanation for origins, so it legitimizes our entire movement." He even dedicated his book, Das Kapital, to Charles Darwin. So they, communists, said, okay, let's get God out of the situation and pull evolution in as an answer, alternative. But then I think as time progressed through the years of the Soviet Union, I think a lot of even top communists realized man wants hope. Man wants the idea of living forever. That's appealing. We have to have something that gives them that, you know, option or that belief or whatever. So they had always said no to religion, but paganism they didn't mind, and earth worship, because they can use it to control people. But that's, to me, like, okay, then they go, okay, with technocracy, maybe we can create eternal life, because we do want that, what Christianity is trying to sell, but we just don't want their God, because he has rules and he is God, and we want to be God ourselves. But it's really funny how they had to progress down that road to appeal to mankind. And that's Yuval Harari, as you know, that's all he talks about. Yes, close to eternal life. It's a sick mind that is so deceived in itself that believes that. I'm like, I can't wait till the day he uploads himself to the computer and we'll see you, Yuval, and you'll see that's not you. The information in your brain is simply information. Even if you could download the brain completely, that's not you. That's your soul is you. And God is, you're going to, your soul is going to stand before God one day. But anyway, that I just those are some things I thought about. But yeah, continue on that. But yeah, I think that's so important. What are some other things that you cover in the book about those relationships and what's going on with
that? The religious aspect of all of this is very important, and by and large, the whole movement would tend towards atheism. I mean, they would say that they tend towards atheism. That's really not true. They're atheistic as far as God with a capital G is concerned. But these are people that have actually spoken. In fact, I think Harari did himself, but geneticists and these scientists that are working on all this, reforming life sort of thing, they vehemently deny the concept of intelligent design. And at the same time, they badmouth evolution, saying that evolution has not been kind to us. It's incomplete. It's full of mistakes. It's full of errors. And it hasn't done mankind or the world any favors because look at us, this is their rationale. So they actually turn around after they, in one side of the mouth, they say, we deny intelligent design. Then they turn around and say, but now, from now on, we are going to be the intelligent designers. We are going to be it. Now, what does that tell you? You said, well, we are going to be God, is what they're saying. We will be gods unto ourselves, collectively, whatever the universal mind, whatever you want to call it. We will be the gods of the future because we are going to design future evolution according to what's right in our own eyes.
That's
right. This is very dangerous because they're playing with life itself. They're playing with life itself. And so far, we see this going dating back to the early 90s with the Agenda 21 conference that took place in Rio de Janeiro, the first Earth Summit that was produced by the United Nations. This conference produced the document Agenda 21, which they said, well, that's the agenda for the 21st century, and we're in that now. But alongside of that, there was another conference, the Biodiversity Convention, that was running. Same group of people, just two tracks running at the same time. The Biodiversity Convention was not about biodiversity as we typically would think about it. It was about genetic manipulation. It was dominated by big tech and the emerging biotech industry back in that day. That was all they were talking about, intellectual property and editing genes and of living things. And probably most people have just watched them saying, it's crackpot stuff. What are they talking about? Science fiction. But they made good on the promise, because since 1992, every conceivable thing on planet Earth has been genetically modified. You can't find one species, class of life. Seeds, for instance, Monsanto took care of that. Crop seeds, grass seeds, everything has been modified now for different reasons. We won't go into it. Insects have been modified. They're making insects with kill switches now, like mosquitoes that go out and breed with the females in the pond, in the water, and the offspring can't live. They die before they're hatched. So the population can be collapsed by 95% in a matter of days. Animals have been genetically modified. Fish, for instance, for fish farming. Double meat pigs, for instance, for pork production. Cows and bovine for milk production and for meat production. Everything on planet Earth has been genetically modified in the last 25, 30 years. This has just kind of snuck up on us a little bit. Well, is there a plan here? Is there like a trend? Well, the last frontier, you remember Star Trek?
Yes.
When the ship is like this is space.
Only go where no man has gone before.
I know, seeking out, new life forms. I know, it just gives you kind of the heebie-jeebies when I talk about this. But the last frontier of genetic modification were humans. That started in 2020 with the release of the pandemic, then the release of the messenger RNA-based shots that were given to the world. We won't have to go in all the details on that. I'm sure you've done that many times. But I said back then, once the needle gets into the arm of humanity with genetic material, which is messenger RNA, now we know, by the way, there was plenty of, there's a payload of DNA in there as well. So it's not just messenger RNA, but that was bad enough in itself. Once the needle got into the arm, there would be a constant conveyor belt from there on to introduce more and more and more genetic material into the human condition, into the human body. Now, we know this is the case. We know the disastrous effects of doing this now, because there's plenty of peer-reviewed studies now, scientific studies that have come out that have shown the danger and the damage that have been done by this messenger RNA technology. Now, this year's, this is 2023, we'll date ourselves. This year, the flu shots that are going to be coming out this fall are going to be based on messenger RNA technology again.
Wow.
And this is the conveyor belt. It will never stop. And every vaccine in the future will be based on messenger RNA being injected into your bodies to do different things, not always the same thing. In the case of the COVID shot, it was to produce a spike protein that was identical to what COVID supposedly produced. And thereby, the body would recognize it and fight against it and so on and so on. What they didn't tell anybody along the way is, well, it's likely to kind of destroy your immune system while it's at it. But, you know, aside from that, you're going to be good.
And your reproductive system,
And your reproductive system. And I know, it's like, it's inconceivable. It's wars. It's crimes against humanity, in my opinion. Just say it flat out. But, you know, they have their conveyor belt now. This was the intentional program of biodiversity starting in earnest in 1992 with genetic manipulation, genetic modification being the primary thing to take over the process of intelligent design. The problem is these mad scientists, these modern Frankenstein scientists, are crackpots, in my opinion, crackpots.
Yeah.
Thinking that they can just, it's just like typing on the keyboard. Oh, made a mistake, backspace, you know, no problem, we'll fix it. These people are mad scientists that redefined the whole Frankenstein genre. It's alive, you know. And there's no stopping them at this point. There's so many people working overtime in universities around the world in these genetics departments, in private companies, you know, like the Pfizers of the world and the Modernas of the world. There are scientists working on this day and night throughout the planet. And there's no way that we can stop it at this point. We can talk about it. But people just don't have an appreciation. Guys, you are in the process. You're making Klaus Schwab proud if you take the shot because we're going to change you. Yes, you're being changed. That's the plan. That's their plan for humanity, is to change humanity. What's really interesting, I haven't really said it yet, but it needs to be said. Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his original book, Between Two Ages, he made the very blunt and bold statement, because I'm sure he understood technocracy to a T. He didn't use a word, but I know he did because he was from Columbia University. He said that Marxism was a necessary stepping stone to get to the technotronic era. Necessary stepping stone. Now, this has bothered me ever since I rediscovered this about 15 years ago and had to go back and read his book again to say, well, what's going on? Like you, I had fought communism, Marxism all my life, basically. So I understood that. I mean, you know, I got it. But what do you mean it's a stepping stone? There's something more? Where's it going? What are you talking about? Where's it going to? And how is it going to be, you know, how's it going to give this going to give way to that? Well, this technocrat crowd set themselves up separately from all of the other isms of the world. Now, this maybe this is just ego, maybe it's personality disorders, another level of pathological dysfunction, I don't know. But they set themselves up as a superclass that found out that they could use the Marxist-based ideologies to promote a scorched earth policy to destroy capitalism and free market economics. In other words, the moral hazard was, they created the moral hazard. What we need to do is get rid of capitalism. How are we going to do that? Let's turn BLM loose. Let's turn Antifa loose. Let's turn critical race theory loose and critical theory loose. It's going to take them down to the ground. And we see this working out today. And, you look at the people who are kind of pulling the strings right now. Bank for International Settlements, for instance, the people there. You look at the Klaus Schwabs of the world. You look at the Elon Musks of the world. You look at the Jeff Bezos. You look at the Peter Thiels and other, the head of Apple and so on. You look at these people, I can't for the life of me make them fit the model of a Marxist. I just can't. I've tried. Every time you turn around, you say, Elon Musk is not a Marxist. He's not a communist. He's not a socialist. He's the richest man in the world. How can you be a socialist and be the richest man in the world? It doesn't fit. But you look at these people, they're moving on their own layer of atmosphere. You know, they're like that spy plane that could fly at 75,000 feet. I mean, they're way above everything else. Elon Musk is operating in an environment that is far above virtually anybody else in the world. And these people seem to be playing these other destructive elements of society to tear it apart. I don't know if this makes sense, but I'm looking at this. Here's what's always concerned me about technocracy. We can and should fight. We should resist this whole Marxist thing because it's crazy. It's all over our country. We know it's embedded in many communities, whatever, an education system, whatever. We need to speak up about this. But what if they themselves are not the source of the problem that's coming upon the world right now? What if it's this superclass, if you will, of technocrats?
I think it's really always been them, because even the globalists 100 years ago, they're the ones putting the communists in power. Like you said, it was a stepping stone, control of the world, but then and to implement a totalitarian system, but through the technology. You don't have to be having the firing squads and the things like that. I agree with you. I think that's what's behind communism. That's what props up, Red China. That's why we trade with them so much, to make sure they're staying around, because we need an enemy to be fearful of. But they need communism in the world. Because it sidetracks us, it's a threat and whatever. But yeah, I think they're behind that 100%. I've thought that for a long time. The super elites, the Rockefeller type, that have a goal of world government, and they're in control. They love communism.
Yeah, I think that Anthony Sutton paved the way for this big time with the work that he did.
Yes.
His Wall Street trilogy, for instance, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and so on, completely exposed the origins and the fomenting, fanning the flames and so on of everything that happened in Russia and Germany and in many other places in the world. And he really nailed it, I think. He had the hard evidence, including things like ship logs and transfer tickets and stuff like that. He really nailed the whole thing. We, in some ways, have the same thing going on today with these technocrats. But what the original objective when technocracy was reinvented in the early 1970s, mostly by Rockefeller being the money guy, was to gain control of all the resources. We saw that back then. They pretty much just kind of, the policies they talked about indicated that they're going to get control of resources. Today we see people like Schwab saying you'll own nothing by 2030 and be happy. Well, this is not rhetoric. He means it.
Yeah, they do.
This was the goal from the get-go, is to get all the resources of the world, put them into a global common trust that you and I will never touch in 1,000 years. And that only those who are licensed to touch that global common trust will be able to draw out resources to make things and control the world, make the world run. This is what we see around the world today. And even in America, people say, oh, America's, you know, property rights are a big thing in America. If most Americans have no idea that Biden cut an executive order when he first entered office to convert 30% of America into property of the United States, bringing the total holdings of property in the United States from 236 million acres up to 790 million acres, wiping out farms, wiping out grasslands, wiping out ranchers. Can you imagine? I mean, you say, well, is this a land grab? Well, duh. Of course it's a land grab. It's like 30% of America is going to be owned by our own federal government. Oh, that's going to work out just great. But, you know, this is happening around the world. It's not just here. The United Nations is gobbling up sections of other countries with their heritage zones and their conservation projects and easements and stuff like that. They've been doing this for years. And now much of the, you know, the resources, the rich areas of the world are now under somebody else's control. This is the whole essence of freezing people out of the private property world into this whole mentality. You're going to own nothing. And of course you won't be happy. Obviously that's the lie of the century, maybe the lie of ever. You'll be happy about owning nothing.
Yeah.
But the owning nothing part, they're dead serious about. I keep telling people they're dead serious. It's just not about losing some property right on your property. You own 10 acres or something like that. That's serious. But we're talking about the whole planet here. They want to grab all the resources of the planet in the end. And that's what technocracy is all about and always has been, grabbing the resources, taking them away from people, managing them in kind of a global common trust for the good of the people, the greater good.
Yes.
But in the end of it, it's just as crackpot as you can imagine. Just totally nuts, insane.
That's where it kind of then blends a little bit with Marxism, because it's always for the common good. I mean, that's their same buzzword.
Oh, yes.
We're going to do what's best for the many, the good of the many, instead of the good of the few. So what's the best place for people to get your book, The Evil Twins of Technocracy and Transhumanism? Where's the best place?
Well, I love to autograph books if people buy from me on technocracy.news, but that's only the printed copy. I can't sell the audiobook and I can't sell the Kindle version. That's on Amazon.
Okay.
And of course I couldn't endorse those anyway. Even if you bought the paperback from Amazon, you can. I couldn't autograph it. So first step is, if you just want a printed copy, you can get it from me. I'll send it out, priority mail, whatever, and autograph it to boot. Otherwise, the Kindle version is also available on Amazon, as well as the audiobook. And I'm hoping many people who don't have time to read, who spend a lot of time on the road, commuting, whatever, will pick up the audiobook and start listening to it in their downtime when they can, driving or whatever.
Yeah, no, that's
so. Yeah, that's the main thing. And the other thing I want to say too, we emailed about this too. I founded an organization in 2018 called Citizens for Free Speech to promote local activism in communities to deal with issues that have come down to local communities. We have a tremendous training program. We just kind of relaunched our training effort. We call it Local Activist Accelerator. And it's a boot camp for local activists, essentially, people who want to get involved, who realize they bloody well better get involved, because you know, like our director of training says, if you don't have a seat at the table these days, you are what's on the menu for dinner. And isn't that the truth? So we're trying to help people get involved in their local community to learn how to change policies, how to have an impact, how to get their voices heard. This really is a free speech issue. In the end, this is the ultimate expression of free speech. It's when you're doing it. It's not a spectator sport. It's a participatory sport. Yeah. You can't say you're a football player until you're on the field playing football. You can watch every game that the NFL has, but you ain't a football player. If you're not on the field throwing the ball or catching the ball or whatever, then you're a football player. That's what local activism and free speech is all about. Yes. You can talk about free speech from the grandstands, but until you're down actually doing it in your local community, you can't really say you possess it. Yeah. It's a participatory event. So we're working hard.
Where do they go to join, become part of that? People, this is the kind of thing I know all of you want to be a part of, because you're the people that like to learn so you can educate and be involved. But he's come up with this group that's their whole point, is to help you even be more equipped and prepared to make a difference right where you are. So this is, how would they go and join them?
Right. They can go straight to our accelerator website, which is localactivist.org. That's easy to remember. Localactivist.org. And they can join there. They can stay on as long as they want to. There's a small fee, monthly fee, but you can join and stay as long as you want. All of our training programs are available within that private community that we've built. And there's two parts to our training. The first, the basic training teaches you how to manage yourself, control your emotions, how to make presentations, how to interact with people you don't agree with, that sort of thing. The second part of our training concerns team building, how to build a team of people to accomplish a common objective between you guys. You know, like if you're after a city council seat or something in your town, and you realize, well, you can't do it by yourself. You need to have a team of people. How do you build that team? What kind of people do you need on it? What are the functions of the team to make it successful, and so on? And so team building is so critical today. People that go out on their own thinking, oh, I'm a one-man army.
Yeah.
We pick up the pieces all the time, those people. they hit the brick wall and pow, you know, they never saw what hit them.
That's right. So
team building and working in teams in local communities is so important. Maybe it's just a small, you know, two or three or four people doing something together. Maybe it's a larger team if the project is bigger than that. But one thing we want to teach people, we cannot keep this lone wolf mentality that we can just shake our fist at the TV hard enough and long enough that something's going to happen. Oh, that's just not the way life works today. I'm sorry, but, you know, so we're big on team building. We provide coaching and mentoring as well, personalized coaching and mentoring to people, to our members. And we want them to grow up to be, if you will, warriors in their local communities, not to be argumentative, not to be, you know, destructive or anything like that. When I say warrior, I'm talking about a statesman, somebody that can be effective in their local community and be persuasive and, you know how to operate, how to, you know, navigate away from trouble spots and stuff and get things done. That's the thing. I remember years ago, you know who Alan Keyes is, I'm sure. He was ambassador to the United Nations for some time. Great statesman.
Yeah.
I believe it was him one time that said that the quality of a statesman, of a true statesman, is you can step on somebody's shoes, but not spoil a shine.
Oh,
I love that.
Yeah.
That's
right.
This, and honestly, this ought to be a Christian value as well.
Oh, absolutely. No,
because really,
when you have the truth, you don't have to be mean-spirited or anything. The truth is what is powerful and effective, especially with the majority out there that's kind of just ignorant of what's going on. When they hear the truth next to the lie they've been told, it makes it like, oh, I didn't know that. And so that's why our job is so important. Well, we'll have both of the links below, the links to get his book And I encourage you to get a physical copy from him because you want to build your libraries. But also, if you enjoy listening, also get a copy on Amazon, get the audiobook so you can listen to it as you're driving around. But you always want a physical copy of things because the way the world is today, as they start unplugging all the digital things they don't like my YouTube channel and so many people's, they just delete it when they realize there's too much truth here. That's what's going to happen to those audiobooks at some point also. So, and then citizens, what is it again? Citizens for Free Speech.
Citizens for Free Speech. That's right. And our master website is citizensforfreespeech.org. Okay. Our local activist training site, the accelerator, is localactivist.org.
Okay. And I'll have all those links right below people. So you can just go right down there and hit them and go to those sites before you forget about it and move on with things. But Patrick Wood, I thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. I always learn a lot listening to you and from the things you've learned over your life, and just and thankful for you.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview. Obviously, if you want to learn more, get his book because it goes into much more detail than we were able to cover. Our verse for this week is Proverbs 17:10. A reproof entereth more into a wise man than 100 stripes into a fool. That means you can simply just correct verbally a wise man. He's going to accept that, and that's going to have more effect on him than if you take a whip out and beat a fool 100 times. You give him 100 lashes, that's not going to be as effective on a fool, because they're a fool, as if you just speak some words to the wise man who says, thank you, I didn't know that's a better way of doing this, or thank you for encouraging me not to do that again because it's wrong, or whatever. Be the wise man. Learn, listen, and then take action to be more like you should be. But I appreciate you greatly. Thank you so much, you that are subscribers, for supporting what we do. We couldn't do any of this without you, and we appreciate you greatly. I hope you have a wonderful week, and until next week, God bless you.